Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizens, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host today, and with me are my co-hosts and dear friends, Marvin Gowron and Chuck Thurston. Good morning, guys.
Hi, Andre. Hi, Chuck. How are you both doing?
Doing well. Doing well. Good morning, Chuck. Oh, hang on. Chuck is muted. He's saying good morning. Not anymore.
Oh, okay. You can hear me all right?
Yeah, sure. We can hear you just fine. Can you hear us okay?
Oh, terrific. Yep, all good.
Good.
Very good.
Yeah.
So we are continuing with our Spheres of Light and Life study, where we had been looking for all the administrative readjustments, and we covered the first four stages, and we'll continue with some brief descriptions of the fifth, sixth, and seventh stages here shortly. But what kinds of things strike you guys from what we were studying last week? And by the way, Paula's not with us. She's out in Indianapolis visiting her son and grandchild with her husband, and just enjoying some time off. She'll be back next week.
All right.
So what do you guys think?
Well, it's a very evolutionary picture, although it seems like the partnership with the higher levels of universe presence and organization increases, perhaps, through these stages.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that struck me is the kind of the progressive and increasing participation of the finaliters, which is really interesting when you think about it. You know, as this part of the universe, the settled universe, moves to its final stages, those of us who have progressed all the way to paradise and then come back begin to really participate in the administration. It's almost like it's a time of practice in a sense. is what struck me. Maybe practice for the finaliters and for all of us, you know, and my guess is by the latter stages of the age of the Supreme, one would hope maybe all of us would, you know, thinking and listening about these things would be finaliters, and we would engage in a period of practice preparatory to going out into the outer space levels, and who knows, you know, what's much larger administrative responsibility. So that's just really interesting that on these
worlds,
you're
saying
finaliters.
It's kind of like training, finaliter training. I mean, the finaliters, you know, are serving, obviously, but you're saying in a sense they may also be training for the next universe age.
Yeah. Well,
I think you're probably right about that. It's really hard to imagine what that's obviously hard to imagine what that's going to look like, but it seems like good practice.
Yeah. It's sort
take
of,
on these
I
roles.
Mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Much of it is speculation, you know.
Well, it makes
right.
sense, though, from the standpoint of what we can at least glean about the outer space levels, and that is that in the finite, everything will be working perfectly. Well, what better way to begin to train for that than to look at worlds where many of the items that one will be dealing with later have reached a stage of near perfection. There are many things that are running well. There are many controls. There are fewer accidents. There are so many coordinated agencies that are working, agencies, by the way, which we can barely fathom here in our stage, in this world where we're getting in spades what doesn't work
and what needs to work
a lot better. You know, we're bringing quite an experience of disorder, experience with disorder and disarray, and frankly, wanton, willful desire for chaos in order to maintain control. And we're seeing all kinds of things like that going, and plus neglect and its consequences. You know, neglect at a higher stage can easily lead to lower stages once again, and we're beginning to see that. We've begun to see the unraveling of some of our systems and things not working as well. And just to take one example, on radio and listening to interviews, and since we're on that kind of medium, the level of interruption, the level of service disruption that is happening just post-COVID because of the remote location aspect, the way people have been having to broadcast, has been remarkable. Just to notice that in something that you would never hear people dropping off, or it was a rare thing, very rare thing. Now communications are disrupted all the time. And it's that kind of thing that we're getting experience with. Well, the experience in a world of light and life is an experience where they have long since gotten control over those kinds of things. And they're functioning on a very high foundation to be able to work on higher order things, things that just aren't possible if you don't have a lot of developed infrastructure underneath, not to mention social systems, not to mention people of character, all of those kinds of things that are in place.
Yeah,
so
well,
I agree with you, good training.
Is, yeah, right. Yeah, the last point about character is a good one, I think. Because one of the things now, then, and at all times in between that, you know, we all work on, and the whole planet works on, and maybe in a way as a whole, is the, you know, the balance between worship and service, you know, the inner and the outer. You know, if the culture becomes too much focused on creation of systems and infrastructure and forgets about the inner life, then that, as we know, can have within it the seeds of its own destruction, you know, that famous interregnum paragraph. But the remedy to that is, you know, a growth in our worship, in our, what do they call it, our worship wisdom. Yeah, our worship wisdom. So that's got to always be kept in the picture. You know, that's, at least that's the prayer. That's sort of what I'm partly sort of getting from this, between the lines at least, is that there's a necessity for balance between the inner development of character, like you're saying, based on spiritual insight, and a growth in the concept of what we worship. You know, it's like getting to know God better than before. Because as individuals, the more we grow closer to God, then the more effective we're going to be in our service, in our outward ministry. And those two together, you can't really go very far with one without the other, I think. You know, like in the book, we over and over again see how worship and service are often appear in the same sentence. You know, it's like two hands, you know, it takes two hands to wash your hands or something like that. You know,
each elevates the other. Yeah.
You're right, to evolve. Right. We need that inner input from God, and then we have to work on the outer implementation of better and new and better ideas and inspired visions and all of that. And that can't happen without on the ground practice, like you're talking about. Anyway.
Well, it's interesting to see.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just in relation to what Chuck was sharing, and I'll be brief here, is, you know, as always, Jesus is this remarkable example. And, you know, there are these periods of time where he would really focus on his interior spiritual integration, the worship. I think he was always doing both plentifully, serving and worshiping. But there were periods of time where he was engaged in very intense ministry efforts and very intense outward service engagements. And then there were periods that he took an interlude, and, you know, like going up on Mount Hermon for several weeks. And the integration of his intellectual life and his spiritual life and his service life is really, I mean, it's an example that is, it's such a stretch for us, given the disorder in our lives much of the time. And, you know, I think one thing we deal with too, that he didn't deal with in anywhere near the degree that we deal with, is the complexities of civilization and the overwhelming flows of information and just the complexity of it. He lived in a simpler world. So, I mean, that was different in his times, but still, I have no doubt he would have accomplished the huge progress on both those fronts, the worship and the service front, and the integration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's an example. Sorry, Andre, you were going to say something.
No, actually, I wasn't. I was going to toss it to you, actually, because, it's interesting, these different ideas we have. It's so far removed from any reality we have, and yet, you know, how is it that we aspirationally understand that this is possible, even though we've never seen it manifest on Earth, even though we see everything that runs counter to this? How is it that we have the sense that, even more than aspirationally, that we expect that this should be possible somehow, and that we should be able to get there somehow? It's an interesting idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that it is. Yeah. That it intuitively rings bells for us, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there must be something in our nature. The thought adjusters, obviously, and the spirit of truth. I mean, many, many elements woven into our nature that intuit the rightness of what they're describing. Yeah, go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, no, I was going to say more or less the same thing, I think. Map for us the future possibilities have already been achieved by other worlds. So we can kind of rest assured that these things are possible, even like you said, we haven't seen it here yet. But still, and then this paper is mostly in terms of like a normal world, And we know, of course, we're not exactly on the normal world. So we have to kind of take from this some ideas about, well, maybe our path's going to be a little different. And one aspect of that that I think is pretty fascinating comes up in the, let's see, the 15th paragraph of the previous section, 55.4.15, where they talk about, I guess this is the third stage, where the elected mortal chief executive, which would be like sort of like a president, the human president of the planet, sort of, I think that means, becomes associated with the planetary sovereign, which would be the planetary prince, if there was one, you know, in a normal world, as joint administrators of world affairs. And I just think that's a really interesting potential, you know, to conceive of that. Like there would be one human that would represent the whole planet, and that person for 25 years would serve alongside the planetary prince as joint administrators.
Yeah.
So you have the human and the superhuman becoming knowingly associated and working together. And that's a stage that, you know, we can obviously look forward to in some form. In our case, it might be Machiaventa. You know, if he steps into his role as vice chair and planetary prince, then maybe he would serve that role. And we would still have an elected mortal representative. So the idea of the whole planet having an election, you know, coming up with one person, one human, to represent the whole human race. It's kind of an intriguing thought, I think. And that's a level of leadership and development.
Well, and remember, there are a number of things that they don't state.
To match the wisdom of the superhuman.
Yeah. There are a number of things they don't recapitulate for us that they expect us to bring to bear on you know, the kinds of things that they're telling us in brevity here. And one of the things would be that they say that as light and life is approached more and more, these positions are served in dual form by a man and a woman. So you notice
true,
that these mortal
chief
executives, okay, they say chief executives in that case, and then previously it's singular. It could be either way on a particular world, but they state elsewhere that more and more these positions are held jointly, and this one may be held jointly as well. And there's a number of other things that they don't state that we need to bring to bear with our imagination. And one is that the last developments of science in the teacher son age, you know, have allowed for the extension of mortal vision and as well as the additional function of the physical controllers, so that now, as a part of culture and normal life, people are growing up and either at some point in their life or all through their life, they are seeing the celestial array of personalities that are functioning on the planet. That's part of their upbringing. That's part of their existence. And that's a remarkable feature. So if you're growing up with this, and this has been a part of culture now for age upon age, we're talking about the third age of light and life here, who knows how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years that is to get to that stage, it's part of culture that we are well served by other beings. We've had the broadcasts. That's also, you know, understated. We don't think about it because we don't have it. So in a certain sense, we don't miss it. But there they are. That's something that they expect all of this to be functioning. And here we are. We're seeing that culture has acclimatized to include more and more of this celestial life to be functioning jointly. And furthermore, mortal civilization has risen to the level whereby it can function jointly. It is now wise enough and reliable enough and trustworthy enough that it can function jointly with these celestial beings with no real problems, or let's say no problems that are not creative problems as opposed to destructive problems.
Yeah, well, there's clear lines of authority too, on the human level as well as the superhuman level, which would be a huge help. Just the fact that they can elect a person to serve as the mortal representative of the planet signifies some significant degree of unification around the process of this sort of thing.
Sure.
But there's whole levels of harmony
and longevity of human life means
for sure.
25 years is in the prime of some mortal chief executive's life. Who knows when that is? Is that at 50? Is it 100?
Or at 200?
Is it 200?
Yeah,
250? You know, when did he? Oh, we had a young chief executive. He was only 100.
Yeah, funny to think about that. Well, who knows what kind of extended training they receive too. The candidates
exactly.
for that role. I mean, they change out actually pretty quickly in the terms you're describing. You know, 25 years
sure.
is that long a time. I mean, it seems long to us. We're used to, you know, people serving for 40 years.
Well, it's basically
years, whatever,
a generation,
but,
you know.
Kind of,
you know, and even then, it's pretty much a generation because people mature when they do, and you'll recall that elsewhere they say it's not wise to extend or prolong too much the childbearing years, and so you can imagine that it's still a feature of, you know, early adult life or relatively early adult life, even if it's, you know, in the 30s or something, that people are having their children, raising their families. And that period of life is, again, something that is so valuable and essential that it's taken seriously during that period. And on the other side of it has created and trained and given a character to the people that have engaged in that child rearing, something that they then carry through the rest of their lives, which is another 450 years, you know?
Yeah, it could be. And that would be true with the men and the women. I mean, what you're pointing out about,
yes,
you know, getting beyond that stage of their life, a lot of these leadership and responsible positions of administration are shared by male-female pairs. And if you think about the corporeal staff of the Planetary Prince, that was kind of designed and set up, I think, to be a template for that, to be an example of that. I mean, they don't stress it a lot in the book, but those corporeal staff members were pairs. You know, it was a male-female pair in every case. And they would be...
From the beginning, that's an example. You're right,
From the very beginning, that's an example, right. And then we have the example of Adam and Eve as well, kind of, again, setting that standard, you know, showing, demonstrating that complementary potential, the creative potential of a complementary relationship. So that's, we're kind of missing that, I think, on this planet. You know, our whole gender thing has, you know, become very confused in a way compared to how simple it could be.
What we're speaking about is that experience comes so early in our experience, even on these advanced worlds, because it's so fundamental, the understanding of parent-child relationship and how it affects our understanding of God's nature and God's ministry to us and forms the basis of our early development in these ages when we live these long lives, and that's foundational. You know, that experience is absolutely foundational for everything that must come afterwards. That's really interesting. That's a universal or near universal experience. I was going to switch to a different kind of theme. I was just looking at when they say these, in paragraph 15 in this section, which I guess we're going to read the remainder of the section first, right? Section 55.4.
That's correct.
Yeah. And so in paragraph 15, they're talking about these moral chief executives. During this or the following age, a teacher son, assisted by the ministering spirit quartet, which is a series of higher beings, seraphic chief of the sphere and a psychographic counselor and archangel translations. We talked about that last time. So there's this administrative assistant group of four that assists the teacher's son, and that whole group works with the planetary sovereign, and this mortal chief executive is the administrator of world affairs. So you're trying to picture what this might look like. And that this mortal chief executive serves for 25 years of planetary time. And it is this new development that makes it easy for the planetary Adam and Eve to secure release from their world of long-time assignment during the following ages. And then the next little paragraph describes the quartet, and I was looking at the paragraph after that, paragraph 17, where they're talking about the fourth stage of light and life. And let me go ahead and read that, because there's something that struck me about it that I think is worth considering.
By all means.
The fourth stage of light and life. And so they're describing in more detail what they've sort of introduced in these paragraphs just before. On these worlds, the Trinity teacher sons appear in new roles, assisted by the creature trinitized sons so long associated with their order, which is what struck me. They now come to the worlds as volunteer counselors and advisors to the planetary sovereign and his associates, which would include this mortal chief executive, right, who are associates of the planetary sovereign. Such couples, meaning Paradise Havona Trinitized Sons and Ascender Trinitized Sons, represent differing universe viewpoints and diverse personal experiences, which are highly serviceable to the planetary rulers. Again, what strikes me is not only is the social culture that we're surrounded with in these far distant ages so radically different, as you have pointed out, Andre, we were talking about, but the integration with higher celestial realities and beings and understandings is so far advanced. It's a very integrated experience of growing up on a physical world, but understanding how integrated we are with the universe as a whole and the unfolding of the universe ages. And when what struck me, and that's part of the culture, is this embeddedness in the larger universe structure. And what struck me is that if I'm remembering correctly, the creature trinitized sons, which are Paradise Havona Trinitized Sons and Ascender Trinitized Sons, which happen way at the far end of our evolutionary process when we get close to paradise, is when we procreate these Trinitized Sons. If I remember correctly, aren't those Trinitized Sons absentite beings? Am I remembering that correctly? That they,
you know,
their nature partake. Yeah, I think they are.
Well, they certainly, one of the things that they tell us is that they're incapable of finite experience. So that would imply that there is at least an absentite aspect to their nature. And they are the personification of an idea held jointly by the two contracting partners who have decided to try to trinitize this independently but mutually held idea. So if it's two mortals, it tends to be an idea that pertains somehow to the material universe. If it's Paradise Havoners, it's some idea that tends to pertain more to spiritual reality. And if it's a combination of the two, which is not what they're talking about coming here, that Trinitized being is immediately goes to Vice Charrington and is held there for the future because it has nothing to do, it has to do with a quality of mind not pertaining to this super universe age at all in any regard.
Yeah.
So that's well, part of what they tell us about the creature Trinitized sons.
Yeah, it just sort of fits in for me with this idea that with the increasing role of the Finaliters and these creature Trinitized sons, that there's a slow, steady evolution of what's happening in this universe that's getting it ready for integration with what will eventually come in the universes of outer space. And the Finaliters are getting ready to, and training almost, and developing things to get ready to make a transition that is sort of an orderly getting ready for a transition to the age of the elders.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, well,
it's interesting to me that on these worlds of light and life, which are evolutionary worlds, you have these beings that I believe are partially absentite in nature, and they're functioning
yes.
here. And what they're saying is they represent different universe viewpoints and diverse personal experiences, which are highly serviceable to the planetary rulers. That's just really interesting. It's such a broad and integrated approach is what strikes me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the
yeah.
last paragraph in that section sort of addresses the absentite thing a little bit, where it says at the end of that paragraph that...
You want to read it?
Well, let me just read it. It's more about
since
the
finalities. Since we're recapitulating, this is like a pre-reading before
yeah,
our other reading
yeah,
anyway.
Okay.
It's good to recap this.
Sure. So this
did,
is
did you read
paragraph
18, Marvin?
No, I was reading 17. Paragraph 17. And one other thing
okay,
to say is just before you, is that this whole paper is structured with sort of previews. Like these are describing the fourth, fifth, sixth stages of light and life, and then there are whole sections in the remainder of the paper that unpack
right.
it. So mm-hmm. that's interesting too. Go ahead, Chuck, sorry.
Yeah, and before I'll just read those two paragraphs, but before I do, there's a little detail at the end of the last paragraph in the third stage, paragraph 16. At the end of that paragraph, they say, but these advisors never proffer counsel unless it is asked for. I think that's really interesting in the sense that there are these high-powered beings, you know, coming to the planet. And how does this all work out and evolve in such a way that the human culture of the planet doesn't lose its ownership of the planet, you know, in the face of these beings coming from paradise, you know, who could easily take over, right? It would seem to me if they chose to, but they've restrained themselves to advisory roles so that the planet,
well,
I assume part of the reason for that is so that the planet can retain its own native culture and not be overwhelmed by what's
mm-hmm.
being
not only that, but there's the element of respect and effectively still the prime directive. I mean, when we think about the idea that once human will has appeared on the planet, the life carriers withdraw and have to take pledges of non-interference and that kind of thing, you know, talking about the beginning age of the, you know, pre-planetary prince age. You know, and it's as soon as human will evolves, the evolution of the planet and its culture is placed largely in the hands of the choices of the human beings there, who at every stage are making choices that advance or retard their human culture, you know, by virtue of what they're doing. And arguably, very, very primitively at first, they don't interfere with how humankind is going to respond to their environment. And so you think about that. That's obtained through every dispensation, you know, through the bestowal sun age, through the teacher sun age. And now, even though there are more and more of these higher celestial beings, that same respect, that same regard, that same prime directive is functioning, because they are truly interested in how this world is going to continue to evolve, even if it's evolving now through the stages of light and life. There is something unique that is happening on each world that they respect, value, and under no circumstances want to interfere with.
That's a really good point, right, Andre. Yeah. It's you know, for those of us who are Trekkie, old Trekkie veterans and fans,
right,
you know, I mean, that the introduction of that idea of the prime directive, you know, that there's almost something semi-sacred about not interfering with the evolutionary trajectory of an individual world and culture, that it's really critically important for them to be allowed to develop the unique and actualize the unique potentials that are inherent in their situations, that principle is almost semi-sacred in the structure of the way the universes are formed and administered. And I think it's neat that you're focusing on it. And I agree with you. And it's interesting that this quartet is they're all seraphim. That struck me as well. They're all orders of, you know, the third source and center. They're all third source and center beings. So they're all angels in one form or another.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why they're a ministering quartet. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We can see the same pattern in our personal growth and development as well, where we're given these, you know, imagine having a fragment of God living within you. You know, what a powerful potential influence that is. Mm-hmm. Or even the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth and the angels, you know, were surrounded and impinged upon by these endowments, spiritual endowments and ministries. But they don't overstep into trying to control our will. That our will remains sovereign and we access these resources, and that's what enables our spiritual growth. But they don't try to rule our lives in a way that would be overbearing or take away our own uniqueness as an agent in the universe. Our agency is not overstepped, which allows each of us to grow in our own unique and personal way. So I think that same principle is applying here on a planetary level, where they're bringing in higher orders of influence, spiritual resources to the planet, but not for the purpose of overpowering the native evolution of the planet, but to upstep it, give it, you know, better advice if necessary or whatever, when it's asked for. That's what I thought was so interesting about that, because they don't give their advice unless it's asked for. And we're kind of in that same position. Okay, God, I want some advice here, right? All right, okay, let's talk, you know. And we're kind of in that same position where we seek that guidance from these spirit resources and, you know, that's been given to us, you know, paramount, being the thought of Chester itself. But even there, they're so careful to say that none of these influences ever overstep into somehow taking away our sovereignty. So over our own growth and progress, such as it may be, that's our responsibility. And so I get the same feeling about the planet, that it's sort of working in a similar way, that these beings don't overstep into usurping kind of the native aspiration for the planet, but they assist and inspire and do all those good things.
Well,
like the Chester does.
Human free will is sacred to them. And
in
the universe, they understand it's sacred to God, else God would not be the bestower of personality on any being. I mean, that's remarkable right there. Will is so precious. God is who chooses to bestow it and bestows it relatively freely. I mean, on even primitive individuals to do with what they may.
For better or worse. Yeah.
For better or worse.
Well, you know,
like,
here's
what,
let's tie
a bow quickly on this. We can pick it up on the other side. Why don't we quickly read through 18, 19, and then just continue to the end of this section And then let's pick up the conversation. I'm sure it'll stimulate some other things, and we can pick up on any loose thread here that we still want to wrap up.
Sure.
Well, I was going to suggest the same thing, Andre, because I had actually read, I thought we were through this and we're picking up on Section 5, which is a fascinating section, so I hope we will get to 5,
but we should button this up. We didn't read those very briefly spoken of stages 5, 6, and then 7 in the Ages of Light and Life. And notice 5 and 6, they say very little about 7, they say a little bit more, because it's almost like an age of ages. You know, once you get to the seventh, they don't say, well, then you get to the eighth. No, the seventh is its own level, but there are many stages within the seventh. Those that are long in the seventh stage, they remark in other places. Anyway,
go ahead. You don't mind, Andre. You know, and you want to read that from... Are you up for reading that?
Well, I think Chuck was keyed up to read it, right, Chuck?
Great.
So why don't you start with 18?
And
then just go all the way through to the end of that section, to 31, and then let's pick up the conversation again right after that.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Yeah, and this paragraph 19 is the one that includes a comment about abstinent beings.
We hadn't read 18, so let's just read that one to recap it.
Right. Got it. Okay. At any time after this age, this being the fourth stage, the planetary Adam and Eve can petition the sovereign creator sun for release from planetary duties in order to begin their paradise, or they can remain on the planet as directors of the newly appearing order of increasingly spiritual society, composed of advanced mortals striving to comprehend the philosophic teachings of the finaliters portrayed by the brilliant evening stars, who are now assigned to these worlds to collaborate in pairs with the Sakonophim from the headquarters of the superuniverse. The finaliters are chiefly engaged in initiating the new and supermaterial activities of society, social, cultural, philosophic, cosmic, and spiritual. As far as we can discern, it will continue this ministry far into the seventh epoch of evolutionary stability. That's an interesting way of referring to light and life. The seventh epoch of evolutionary stability, when, possibly, they may go forth to minister in outer space, whereupon we conjecture their places may be taken by abstinite beings from paradise. So that's referring to the finaliters, but even so, that's interesting. I'll just keep reading so we don't get bogged down. Okay, here's the fifth stage, of light and life. The readjustments of this stage of settled existence pertain almost entirely to the physical domains and are of primary concern to the master physical controllers. Wow, who knows what that could mean? The sixth stage of light and life witnesses the development of new functions of the mind circuits of the realm. Cosmic wisdom seems to become constitutive in the universe ministry of mind. Whoa. So we got physical, then mind, and now the seventh stage of light and life. Early in the seventh epoch, the Trinity teacher counselor of the planetary sovereign is joined by a volunteer advisor sent by the Ancients of Days. And later on, they will be augmented by a third counselor coming from the super universe supreme executive, loaded up with advisors. During this epoch, if not before, Adam and Eve are always relieved of planetary duties. So during this epoch, if not before, Adam and Eve are always relieved of planetary duties. If there is a material son in the finaliter core, he may become associated with the mortal chief executive. And sometimes it is the Melchizedek who volunteers to function in this capacity. If a midwayer is among the finaliters, all of that order remaining on the planet are immediately released. Oh, I see. Okay. So it can have material sons and midwares among the finaliters, and they relieve the existing beings of that order who long served. Okay. So
interesting that they're really speaking about a characteristic that is pertaining to that order of being that's important. But, yeah, let's come back to that.
Yeah, right. And the idea that the finality core isn't just former mortals. It also includes these other types of beings. Upon obtaining release from their age-long assignment, the planetary Adam and Eve may select careers as follows. Okay, these are their options. They can secure planetary release and from the universe headquarters start out immediately on the paradise career, receiving thought adjusters at the conclusion of the Marantia experience. Two, very often a planetary Adam and Eve will receive adjusters while yet serving on a world settled in light, concomitant with the receiving of adjusters by some of their imported pure aligned children who have volunteered for a term of planetary service. Subsequently, they may all go to universe headquarters and there begin the paradise career. They get joined by their kids and then they all go on together. Three, a planetary Adam and Eve may elect, as do material sons and daughters from the system capital, to go direct to the Midsonite world for a brief sojourn there to receive their adjusters. Four, they may decide to return to the system headquarters, there for a time to occupy seats on the Supreme Court, after which service they will receive adjusters and begin the paradise ascent. They may choose to go from their administrative duties back to their native world to serve as teachers for a season and to become adjuster indwelt at the time of transfer to the universe headquarters. Throughout all of these epochs, the imported assisting material sons and daughters, imported assisting material sons and daughters exert a tremendous influence on the progressing social and economic orders. They're potentially immortal, at least until such time as they elect to humanize, receive adjusters, and start for paradise. On the evolutionary worlds, a being must humanize to receive a thought adjuster. All ascended members of the mortal core of finaliters have been in adjuster indwelt and fused, except Seraphim. And they are father indwelt by another type of spirit at the time of being mustered into this core.
Thank you. Huh. Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah,
some fascinating things to delve into.
Robert, what
would you like to comment on? And then let me go to you, Chuck.
I'm sorry. I don't have anything right off the top.
Okay. Well, let me just start, for me, what's kind of interesting is this material son and daughter, these elective different ways of joining the ascension scheme. And to me, a really curious one is going to the Midsonite world for a brief sojourn. And, you know, for our listeners, the Midsonite world, there's one in every system. And it is a world where a Melchizedek life carrier and a daughter Eve have procreated that interesting order of beings that are material but never die, that live for 1,000 standard years, read 5,000 Urantia years, and then translate to, first of all, the system worlds, and then from there go up to the local universe Midsonite world where they're foregathering for a service they know not exactly what, but it's suspected they may have something to do with the universes of outer space as well. But why would the material sons and daughters particularly benefit from that kind of sojourn as well on that kind of world, which they're certainly aware of? They have grown up in the system. They may have visited at some point. It's very curious to me as to why that would be significant, except that it's also this kind of world that might emulate in this universe age the kinds of worlds that may be existent in the universes of outer space, of the first outer space level. So that's just a thought, maybe to prime the pump for discussion. Any thoughts?
Well, the whole midsonite thing is very, very interesting, but kind of hard to get a grip on. They even comment in paragraph 36.4.8, they say, the purpose of the midsonite creatures is not at present known. So
yeah.
It's, you know, you have to consider, I mean, it sounds like they exist in preparation for something that's going to happen later. That's usually what that means when they talk that way. Like these
yeah,
beings.
That's what it sounds like.
A purpose in the future. They say that sentence even goes on to say, but it would appear that these personalities are foregathering on the seventh Sinaliter world in preparation for some future eventuality in universe evolution. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, but back to where we were, the material sons and daughters are such an interesting phenomenon, just in general, that that type of being would be provided, you know, a material being, but originated on a higher level, in a sense, and that they
a high ideal of what a material being is.
Yeah. Yes, right, right. They have this unique capacity to serve in this bridging kind of way. We're bridging the material with the spiritual, you know, which is kind of what Adam and Eve do when they fulfill mm-hmm. their mission. They're very, very physical. As a matter of fact, they even bring the Adamic blood to the planet. But yet at the same time, they're also representing high spirit ideals and possibilities.
You know, I'm trying to think, and it's not occurring to me, maybe one of the two of you might know. You know, one of the characteristics of the Adams and Eves is that they procreate. You know, they create
mm-hmm.
offspring that are obviously persons and personality. So personality is bestowed, and along with human beings and at various levels, they also procreate the midwayers. So that's an interesting thing, too, and I don't remember, well, I guess there are other orders that create their own offspring. Yeah, like the father Melchizedek, for instance. But anyways, it's just interesting that the experience of procreation is common to them as well as common to us, which must
mm-hmm.
be, that's a pretty unique phenomenon.
Yeah, most beings don't have that kind of experience. They're created at a higher level, but they never have offspring of their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, angels are like mm-hmm. that. Angels are created where they are, and they can progress from where they are, but they never beget offspring of any kind.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a comment in that same midsonite section that's kind of interesting, 36.4.3, where they point out at the end of that paragraph that the ability to reproduce is lost when you go through the dematerialization process for entheraphoming.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could just, this paragraph's a little out of context, but it includes that. Interesting. I'd never kind of focused on that before. I mean, but it could explain why seraphim can't reproduce, because they're all the time, you know, they serve in the transport roles many times. But it says the midsonite creatures live and function as reproducing beings on their magnificent worlds. until they're 1,000 standard years of age, which is what you mentioned, Andre, whereupon they are translated by seraphic transport. Midsoniders are non-reproducing beings thereafter because the technique of dematerialization, which they must pass through in preparation for enseraphiming, forever deprives them of reproductive prerogatives. So you have to wonder if that would be true of the material sons and daughters who come to the planet, or even the children of our Adam and Eve who may come back. If they, I don't know, I don't know quite how that would even work, how they transport material beings. I mean, with Adam and Eve, they did a dematerialization process, right? But when they were rematerialized, they hadn't lost their, they had not lost their reproductive capacity. So I don't know if this is
right.
So this statement applies in all cases or just about the Midsoniders. It sounds like a general statement, though, that dematerialization causes the loss of reproductive potential.
Well, which would make sense. It's like saying that when you don't have a material body, you can't reproduce material beings. Well, that would make sense. And maybe some of what they're trying to convey is that even if you were put into a new material body, so there's you have essentially destroyed or disintegrated, let's say disintegrated, the ability to reproduce as a result of dematerializing those, you know, gametes, you know, those those various, you know, sperm or egg or genetic material that has the potential for reproduction. So, yeah, interesting. But what's curious here is saying this in the context of their dematerialization, which they pass through and forever deprives them of reproductive prerogatives. You mean as a 999-year-old, okay, in standard years, that nearly 5,000 years old, they haven't lost the prerogative of reproducing? What does that mean? You know, I mean, they're probably not reproducing all through those 5,000 years, equivalent of Urantia years, but holy cow. That would indicate, well, read the next paragraph because it kind of indicates where we're going here. These beings don't really age, at least not the way we would regard aging.
Paragraph four,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. It says the present status of these beings can hardly be reckoned as either mortal or immortal. Neither can they be definitely classified as human or divine. These creatures are not adjuster indwelt, hence hardly immortal, but neither do they seem to be mortal. No Midsonider has experienced death. All Midsoniders ever born in Nebadon are alive today, functioning on their native worlds, on some intervening sphere, or on the Salvington Midsonite spheres in the Finalers group of worlds. So, very mysterious.
Yeah.
And very odd and unusual.
Well, I mean, it's one thing, neither mortal nor immortal, because they never die, but can't be classified as human or divine? Excuse me?
Right.
Divine?
Well, they don't have adjusters. I mean, someday.
No, they don't have adjusters, but they have that potential, that life potential that is conveyed by a Melchizedek combining with a Mother Eve. And, I mean, all bets are off. That's the one I speak tongue-in-cheek to people and say, I would like. I'm taking people to sign on.
Given their origin.
For a trip to the Midsonite world of Satania, I'm trying to get names and kind of like Diane LeBrec, one of our faithful listeners from the beginning of the show, mind you. I was reminded of that by Paula for the 12 or so years of this show. Well, she very often organizes a trip to Israel. Well, Diane, I'm I'm trying to organize a trip to the Satania Midsonite World. God knows when they'll let me go there. But anybody that wants to go should be an interesting trip.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and the irony
so you're,
is that
you're forming,
these material
you're forming
sons and daughters.
Theory.
I'm taking names. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But it's on these Midsonite. It's on this. Wait, they go directly to the Midsonite world for a brief sojourn there to receive adjusters. So these material
yeah.
sons and daughters, that's one of their path, optional paths. It's to experience a brief sojourn on the Midsonite world and there to receive their adjusters. So even though the Midsoniters don't have adjusters, somehow that experience prepares these material sons and daughters to receive adjusters. So how
it's quite curious.
I don't know.
It's
but
quite curious,
these
isn't
comments
it?
About what do you guys think of these comments about humanizing? I mean, you've got these beings who, you know, like they've been around forever. I mean, these are like high beings, but they have to humanize in order to receive adjusters. That's just
mm-hmm.
so. The last two paragraphs that we just read in that part four, back in our regular reading. Both those paragraphs refer to humanizing. And
yeah.
I have to wonder what exactly they mean by that. But it seems to be a requirement to receive an adjuster.
Well,
yeah.
Go ahead,
Mark.
Parenthetically, are Adam and Eve, after they defaulted, did make a decision to humanize, receive the adjusters, and then have proceeded, and they're continuing to serve, I think, in the local system. But
they're on the
but
council.
They elected to move through that stage of humanization, which is really interesting. And that sentence, the last sentence in the second last paragraph, say they are potentially immortal. Speaking now of all the progeny, the material sons and daughters that have been working on the planets, they are potentially immortal, at least until such time as they elect to humanize, receive adjusters, and start for paradise. So that's one of the main ways that they make transition from mortal to immortal status, is to humanize. And apparently, if you're on an evolutionary world, that's the only way to do it. To humanize and then make that choice and choose an adjuster and choose immortality.
So what does
so
it
that,
mean
yeah.
to humanize in that sense is really, I think, I hear as the implied question that you're bringing
yeah.
up,
right.
Marvin, because of
yeah.
the curiosity
yeah.
in that. And what strikes me is, you know, what our human condition is to make choices that co-create our better selves to come all along the way. And perhaps, I mean, they are stationary beings. They're certainly growing in wisdom, but they don't grow particularly in terms of their status of being. They remain material sons. They remain at their stage and continue to function at that stage for, you know, sometimes it would seem to be, millions and millions of years. So what does it mean to humanize in this sense? In some sense, it means to moronshize, to have your character translated into morancha form, into a soul that can grow, which is one of the implications of Marantia, is that it can grow, which is interesting because of what it implies about other statuses, spiritual statuses and other kinds of non-Marantia levels that correspond. For instance, when they talk about the Univitatia, they definitely state that the Univitatia, I mean, they're all, the 70 forms are all at the forms, the same level of Marantia that we are at, but they are not Marantia beings. They are decidedly not this heterogeneous mixture that we are of matter and spirit interwoven, they seem to be homogeneous.
Go ahead on, Brad.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I did do in a search engine put in the word humanized, and which is interesting, and there were some other mentions of the term, you know, like humanizing God, which are not relevant to what we're talking about. And the only paragraph that really unpacks it a little bit is paper 31.5.2. Otherwise, the only references, there are only six references to the word humanize in the text. And the only one that really unpacks it is this one. And so I'll just go ahead and read it. When an advanced evolutionary world attains the later eras of the age of light and life, the material sons, the planetary Adam and Eve, may elect to humanize, receive adjusters, and embark upon the evolutionary course of universe ascent leading to the core of mortal finalities. Certain of these material sons have partially failed or technically defaulted in their mission as biologic accelerators, as Adam did on Urantia. And then are they compelled to take the natural course of the peoples of the realm, receive adjusters, pass through death, and progress by faith through the ascendant regime, subsequently attaining paradise and the core of the finality. So maybe that's parenthetically descriptive of what they mean to humanize, being compelled to take the natural course, receive adjusters, and obviously passing through death. So that obviously has quite a bit of significance, passing through the experience of death. What feels like an end point, and must be progressed through by faith, and they say, and progress by faith through the ascendant regime. So that's interesting. That's the only place where they unpack that a little, what that term humanized means.
Yeah. So that's what happened with our Adam and Eve, and they had no choice about it. The default, they became human, just like the rest of us. Maybe not quite like the rest of us, but they died of old age, lost the connection to the tree of life and all of that. But back where we're reading, it sounds like they're saying that Adam and Eve can also elect to do this voluntarily after having completed their mission.
Right.
So that can happen two different ways, apparently.
Yeah, it sounds
there
like
has to be a certain...
It sounds like to me like what they're describing here is there's a set of choices that these Adam and Eve have. And that's another question, is whether they make that choice as a pair or they make it as individuals. I imagine they make it as individuals, but I can't imagine them making different choices because they always stay together is the sense I have.
Uh-huh.
They function as a pair. But, maybe.
Virtually
not.
Always, yeah.
But,
we don't know if there are any defaulting
know.
Pairs that one of the Adams or one of the Eves decided not to default when the other defaulted. There's,
well, I'm actually...
we know it's happened a few times.
Mm-hmm. The paragraph after the one you read, Marvin, brings this up. In an interesting way. That question about pairing.
Why don't you read it, and then I'll go back. Then I'll go back to 55 because it'll make another point.
All right. Great. So in this in that paragraph you read from paper 31, they're talking about finality or companies, which are mostly ascendant mortals, but then there's a sprinkling in of other types of beings, like midwares, material sons, whatever, in some cases. So they're saying that in this case, they're talking about glorified material sons who become part of finality companies. And this last paragraph, they say that these material sons are not to be found in many finality companies. Their presence lends great potential to the possibilities of high service for such a group, So in the paper we're reading, when they talk about the finaliters coming to serve on the planet, I think they come in companies. And within those companies, they may or may not have these other beings. And what they're describing here are material sons and daughters that can be part of those finaliter companies, saying that they lend great potential to the possibilities of high service for such a group, meaning a group of finaliters. And they're invariably chosen as its leaders. If both the Edenic pair are attached to the same group, so when they say if they're, I assume that implies that that may not always be the case. I don't know. But they say if both of the Edenic pair are attached to the same group, they are usually permitted to function jointly as one personality. Such ascendant pairs are far more successful in the adventure of trinitizing than are the ascendant mortals. So another odd, interesting detail.
Well, and lots of interesting detail. But just going back to paper 55. So looking at that whole stretch of paragraphs from about the Adams and Eves, which is, I guess, paragraph 23 through the end of the section. All of these Adams and Eves seem to get a choice, not only the planetary, the ones that serve as planetary leaders, but all of their progeny as well seem to have the opportunity to make a choice at some point to either on an evolutionary world humanize, receive adjusters, and proceed forward in the evolutionary ascent and maybe become candidates for finaliter service, or else a number of other routes that do not involve humanization, but do involve the receiving of a thought adjuster in other positions in the universe. They go directly there, and they don't do it via the humanization route, is how I'm reading it, which is interesting.
So it seems.
Yeah, they have
humanizing
differential opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it says on the evolutionary world, the being must humanize to receive a thought adjuster. So if they if they've moved on to the system capital or serving on the Supreme Court or any of these other options, and apparently they have the option or they can receive thought adjusters without apparently humanizing.
Yeah.
But on the evolutionary world, the being, I guess, has to be in human, meaning material form, to receive a thought adjuster. I don't know, that brings up all kinds of questions about adjutant mind and cosmic mind and Marantia, like you were mentioning a minute ago, and how all this impinges on the, the Marantia development of such an individual. There's many, many unanswered, many, many intriguing questions there about the humanizing. To what extent is that physical? To what extent is that Marantia, for example? And does that mean they have adjutant mind, or are they just automatically graduated to the level where they're given that superimposition of Marantia mind? And the psychic circles, and just so many.
Well, it would seem like they are not having to go through lower attunement with the adjutants, that they would already be functioning in such a way that even if they had adjutant mind, they'd all be functioning in formation, so to speak. Which would almost then obviate the need for adjutant mind, since it seems that the Holy Spirit or Marantia mind is really effectively based on that kind of coordinated mind at its lowest level and goes up from there. That's at least one way of conceiving of it.
Right, right. So this would be an advanced form of human that they turn into.
Right.
It would seem.
Well, I think
but that would be appropriate to their level of spiritual development.
I think the
other thing to keep in mind is these are beings, all of the material sons and daughters, including the many progeny that had been alive for eons and eons, either on a an inhabited world or up on the system worlds, living long lives, accumulating long experiences before they ever came to this juncture where they make the decision. It's sort of like the midwares, you know, being alive for tens of thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of years. So they've accumulated a huge experience at this stationary level as Adams and Eves before they make this transition to either humanize or go on to the higher levels and then and receive an adjuster and begin the evolutionary ascent. So that's pretty different from our experience. I mean, our experience is before, you know, when we make this choice to receive an adjuster, the implication is either on this world or some combination of an evolutionary world and the mansion worlds, a relatively short but intense period of formation and choice making before beginning the eternal ascent and then doing it in conjunction, in partnership with our indwelling spirit. They have a different experience, as do the midwares. So
well, think about all the vicarious human experience they have as leaders of humanity, of effectively trying to coordinate and assist at every stage the next right administrative decision to advance civilization for their partly their progeny. And partly, you know, their adopted progeny, those that are the material creatures whom they've come to upstep. And that I'm sure qualifies them as having had the equivalent over that length of time of an extensive human experience. They certainly can relate and sympathize with what human beings go through after that length of time and bringing humanity up from a stage that is pre-international, okay, that is still a warring society by the time they come on the stage, up through to internationalism and the stages either of world government or just before, by the end of their age, and then through all those other ages on a normal world. And that's quite an extensive experience with humanity that they've undergone.
Starting when we're tribal, the earliest formations beyond family and tribal, almost animal level existence. Yeah.
Right.
I've got a syntax question.
Sure.
In this paragraph 30.
And then let's try to move to
go
a
on to the next
here,
section, yeah.
And then come back just to
well,
get
you know,
through
I
that
thinking,
next section.
I was thinking, before your syntax thing, I was thinking, Andre, it might be nice to read this section because there's a lot in this section, and then reread it next time when Paula can join us because I'm sure she'd have thoughts on this section number 5. It's got so much interesting information. So anyways,
sure, it's a short section,
well,
just 6 paragraphs. Sure. Do you want to read it, Marvin, or do you want me to read it? Go ahead.
Well, Chuck, you had a syntax thing you wanted to
well,
before we
yeah,
do
I don't know. Maybe it's not that important. But in that paragraph 30, they talk about imported assisting material sons and daughters throughout all of these epics, and that these imported material sons and daughters exert this tremendous influence. And so that's in addition to our Adam and Eve, I assume, is what they're talking about there. And then they say they are potential. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think in some cases they do, and some cases they don't bring in additional material sons and daughters. Yeah, it's hard to say. It's ambiguous. Let's put it that way.
A little bit. But then this sentence, they say, referring to these imported material sons and daughters, says they're potentially immortal, at least until such time as they elect to humanize. So when I first read that, I said, oh, when they become humanized, their immortality is maybe at risk. But I don't think that's what that sentence means. I think that they become immortal when they humanize and receive adjusters. And before that, they're only potentially immortal. I think is what this, that sentence is saying. But there's context.
Yeah,
the syntax. The syntax is a little, seems a little ambiguous there.
You know, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Yeah. I mean, they are effectively immortal as material sons and daughters if they never rebel or default. You know, there's definitely that. So there's that potential immortality as well. So there's almost double entendre here because you can definitely read it the way you have that.
Uh-huh.
When they elect to humanize, receive adjusters and start for paradise, they would still be potentially immortal until they fuse with that thought adjuster, but they are still potentially immortal at that point. I mean, we're potentially immortal, but...
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But not in this life.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I was mainly trying to sort out if by humanizing, they're actually taking on some risk. I mean, probably not, but...
Well, they might be in a certain guarded sense.
Yeah, but I don't think that's really...
Certainly Adam and Eve, in default...
Well, yeah, there you go.
Took on risk.
Right, if they had joined the rebellion...
knew not what they were taking on. Yeah.
If they had actually joined with Caligastia, then they would have lost their immortality. So
that would have been
possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of material sons and daughters on the system world did join the rebellion. So those ones that stuck with it, a lot of them, I think, repented and reconsidered their decision. But the ones, assuming there's some who didn't reconsider, they would have lost their immortality.
Yeah.
So that their immortality was indeed potential because they demonstrated that it was possible to rebel and lose it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, let's move ahead with this reading. And go ahead, Marvin. Why don't you read these six paragraphs, and we'll come back and discuss them and any other loose threads we still need to discuss. Well, there are a few things from the previous section I'd like to discuss as well. But go ahead, Marvin.
Okay. Five. So we're in paper 55, section 5, the acme of material development. Mortal creatures living on a sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, isolated world such as Urantia can hardly conceive of the physical perfection, the intellectual attainment, and the spiritual development which characterize these advanced epochs of evolution on a sinless sphere. There's a lot right there. That list, sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, and isolated, describing our world. Kind of sobering. Continuing with the second paragraph, the advanced stages of a world settled in light and life represent the acme of evolutionary material development. On these cultured worlds, gone are the idleness and friction of the earlier primitive ages. Poverty and social inequality have all but vanished. Degeneracy has disappeared, and delinquency is rarely observed. Insanity has practically ceased to exist, and feeble-mindedness is a rarity. The economic, social, and administrative status of these worlds is of a high and perfected order. Science, art, and industry flourish, and society is a smoothly working mechanism of high material, intellectual, and cultural achievement. Industry has been largely diverted to serving the higher aims of such a superb civilization. The economic life of such a world has become ethical. War has become a matter of history, and there are no more armies or police forces. Government is gradually disappearing, self-control is slowly rendering laws of human enactment obsolete. The extent of civil government and statutory regulation in an intermediate state of advancing civilization is inverse proportion to the morality and spirituality of its citizenship. I'll read that sentence again. The extent of civil government and statutory regulation in an intermediate state of advancing civilization is in inverse proportion to the morality and spirituality of the citizenship. Schools are vastly improved and are devoted to the training of mind and the expansion of soul. The art centers are exquisite and the musical organizations superb. Temples of worship with their associated schools of philosophy and experiential religion are creations of beauty and grandeur. The open-air arenas of worship assembly are equally sublime in the simplicity of their artistic appointment. The provisions for competitive play, humor, and other phases of personal and group achievement are ample and appropriate. A special feature of the competitive activities on such a highly cultured world concerns the efforts of individuals and groups to excel in the sciences and philosophies of cosmology. Literature and oratory flourish, and language is so improved as to be symbolic of concepts as well as to be expressive of ideas. Life is refreshingly simple. Man has at last coordinated a high state of mechanical development with an inspiring intellectual attainment and has overshadowed both with an exquisite spiritual achievement. The pursuit of happiness is an experience of joy and satisfaction.
Thank you, Marvin.
Wow. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's interesting
sort of like
that they say the pursuit of happiness there to echo what's in our Declaration of Independence. You know, I've often discounted the pursuit of happiness as being maybe a little too pie in the sky, especially in the light of the statement which has appealed to me more, that happiness cannot be pursued, it must ensue. But apparently in Light and Life, happiness can be pursued as well. And I guess hearkening back to there is no happiness without intelligent effort, that might also enlighten those statements. But
right.
Interesting
it
that they make it here.
Just one's own personal happiness. I mean, talking about I'm going to pursue my happiness. I mean, that sounds kind of self-centered. It could be that this is also pertaining to the happiness of the whole, right? That these products of culture and art and music and everything else brings happiness to everyone. That's part of what they're implying there.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's an experience of joy and satisfaction culturally and civilizationally as well as individually.
Right.
Perhaps.
Yeah, no, that's what it sounds like. I mean, we can expect that if we're talking about a utopian or, you know, quasi-utopian era, that foundation is very high and would allow for direct pursuits. The people of that kind of a civilization would have the tools and the individual development to pursue that. They're whole individuals. They're growing in a very balanced fashion. So,
you're right. And
something we know
that
very little about.
Well, you think about family culture, even. You know, that would be part family culture, possibly, the pursuit of happiness in a legitimate sense. And that, again, would contribute to the overall social, you know, the tone and attitude and the aspirations of the civilization would be reflected in the families as well.
Yeah.
Which is interesting to think about. I mean, they don't bring up family life in this section, but you have to imagine that that's a big part of this, is the evolution of family life.
Yeah. Well, what I try to imagine is, you know, in the development of a family, that it's so well known and so well educated toward the making and the growth of good parents, that everybody knows what the good stages are and the right things to do for children at each stage. That it's, and it's not wooden that way, but it's been woven into the culture that everybody knows you do this at 3 years of age and you do this at 5 years of age. And all the way along, it's like a dance between the parents and the children. And they all take individual forms. It's not all one way. But there are certain things that are done that they're accomplished maybe in a variety of different ways. But nevertheless, those stages, those marks are hit by the vast, vast majority of all families. And when they're not hit, those educational stages, it's noteworthy in the civilization. And civilization steps in and does something. You can imagine all of that occurring. It's that important. It's that important at that point.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to just, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead and remark on that. And then I wanted to just harken back to the previous section for three different
things. Well,
I was gonna
change course with something else in what we just read. So why don't you go ahead? I can come back to what I was
sure.
Say.
Yeah, let me just go back to paragraphs 20 through 24 in the previous section, since we really didn't talk too much about them. That fifth stage of light and life, having to do almost entirely with the physical domains and are of primary concern to the physical controllers. I think of that as being a little kind of funny to put it that way. I'm sure it's entirely important to the human beings on that planet as well, because what it represents, I mean, even though they've gotten a great deal of control over the physical domain by that point, I'm sure weather control is in there. I'm sure tectonic control has been asserted. It's hard for us to imagine those kinds of things at this stage because of the forces involved, but you can imagine that greater and greater control are achieved at that point. But that at some point, having done virtually anything that's humanly possible, that there is almost like these finishing touches that are done by the master physical controllers that allow for, you know, slight or maybe great tectonic adjustments to occur that finally stabilize things or make sure that they keep stabilizing, or the same in terms of weather, or the same in terms of any number of other kinds of considerations, whether they be atmospheric, whether they be electrical, whether they be, you name it, in the physical realms. That kind of control has been achieved. And then in the next paragraph where they're talking about mind, again, mind is developed. Wisdom has been achieved. But there's been so much achieved that now it's possible on that layer of experiential wisdom that it's almost reached the level of cosmic wisdom, and now it's possible for mind to engage on an equal level. It's almost as though you've reached that level of mind, and now mind can reciprocate and directly complement experiential wisdom with cosmic wisdom. And I'm not pretending to know what that means exactly, but it has to do with this idea of having achieved a level that now can truly reciprocate in the realm of mind. And again, in the Urantia book, mind is a definite reality that's not just something that's rooted in the physical brain. Moreover, the physical brain is a receptor of mind. Mind to function for human beings that otherwise wouldn't function the way it does.
Because it's our wireless connection to mind. This comment that's number six, though, that reminds me of the comment elsewhere in the book where they talk about after having mastered all of the psychic circles, it's possible to receive an overlay, or I don't know if that's the right word, but overlay or superimposition of Urantia mind onto Adjutant mm-hmm. mind. But that's potential for us, even during this lifetime. But probably
And the way I've understood it well. Go ahead.
I'm just suggesting number seven maybe is about that happening in a more general way. Like everything has evolved to the point where people are living longer. This is more spiritual civilization. So this becomes maybe a common thing for people to achieve that level of accomplishment and development. Mm-hmm. At which time this new function of mind circuits would become maybe more generalized. Maybe that's kind of what they're talking about. The Urantia mind becomes more of a reality, people's everyday experience perhaps. And that would bring this capacity for cosmic wisdom that apparently goes beyond the spirit of the adjutant spirit of wisdom.
Well, I think it would harken back to whether you look at, Maslow or whether you look at Eric Erickson's, stages or whatever, that those would be reckoned in that age as the very, very beginnings of something that is then known to exist in many, many other refinements and are known, are as clear as you can see, Long's Peak on a clear day, from far across the plains. It's they just live, eat, and sleep and breathe those realities. They understand mind the way you and I understand, driving down US 36. So.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that relates to this. I think what we're speaking about relates to that first paragraph in section 5 as well, because what they mention in that first short paragraph is three elements, physical perfection and the intellectual attainment and the spiritual development, which characterize these advanced epochs of evolution on the sinless sphere. So I think both physically and intellectually, there's encirclement that results in much, much improved equipment for accomplishing the stages of merging with the universe function on the part of an individual world. So, and I think we can't even imagine what it's like. And in fact, that's exactly what they say in that first paragraph. They use the terms can hardly conceive. It's what you're struggling to describe, Andre and Chuck. It's like we're grappling even to conceptualize what the physical changes would be in our nature and in the nature of the world, the intellectual attainments that would be possible because of different mind circuitry, I think, and the spiritual development. It's like we can hardly even imagine what that would be like. They can describe it to us and we can accept it on some level on faith, that it's radically, radically different.
You're right. Yeah. The idea that cosmic wisdom becomes constitutive in the ministry of mind.
Mm-hmm.
That again, I think they're talking about something beyond adjutant wisdom. That cosmic wisdom points to something more directly connected to the cosmic mind or more directly influenced by Marantia in that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, something to look forward to, I guess. I mean, we can aspire to all of these things, actually, now. I mean, not bringing in beings from other parts of the universe, but these kinds of, you know, vectors of development that they're describing, even in our own little way, we can like, I want to do that, you know, and, you know, we can at least aspire. I mean, this, the thing about the way the Urantia book maps out future possibilities is it creates pathways of aspiration. You know, it's kind of like the consulting influence of these high beings. They don't take over and rule the planet, but what they bring to the planet is inspiring and stimulates new visions of possibility for, you know, the mortal administrators of the world. Just like we administer our own lives, we receive higher visions of what's possible by reading about this stuff. So I think that's part of the reason why they include it. Even though it's out of reach for us right now, it still maps a path forward. So we have a framing of our efforts that includes, like, the sense that we're contributing maybe to this development, even if it's far in the future. We can at least be on the team, you know, that's working in that direction. And I think that's an exciting, you know, thing about the Urantia book, the way it does that.
Yeah. Yeah, really good points.
Just the contrast in that first paragraph of section five. Just the words they describe. Say, mortal creatures living on it's quite a list. Sin-stricken, it's describing our world. Sin-stricken, evil-dominated, self-seeking, isolated world, such as Urantia. It's quite a list of descriptive adjectives.
Could you add another pejorative term, please? Yeah.
Right.
What else can
right.
you say? That's enough. Evil dominated.
Yeah.
Sin stricken.
Yeah.
You know, my goodness. People willfully going against what is right. You know, just to start off with, this is stated as an unusual feature of a world. All of these things are unusual.
They're a legacy of rebellion.
Mm-hmm. But they're unusual.
Yeah, right. Most people don't go into rebellion. So that puts us in a special category, right?
Well, and very related to our isolation. We're cut off.
That's why we feel isolated, We don't have visible superhuman presence. But the other thing in that paragraph that I think is equally interesting is what they say right at the end, where they talk about advanced ethics of evolution on a sinless sphere.
Yeah.
So they're suggesting that sin does not occur on non-rebellion worlds. You know, like where Jesus says that sin and rebellion were brought to this world. You know, that
what they describe later on, I mean, in this section, I caught on that as well, Chuck, that is, that's interesting, a sinless sphere. And what I got from that is the potential for sin is certainly there in these ages of light and life. It's always there. Because free will choice is always there, but what they're saying is that the culture, the culture and the individuals within it have progressed to such an extent that it's nearly non-existent that people make the choice of sin in those worlds.
Well, I would say maybe interpret that a little differently to say that these sinless spheres are worlds where sin has never occurred. That it was never brought to those worlds in line with what Jesus says. I mean, the Urantia book has this distinction between evil and sin that I think it's kind of confusing, or maybe, well, because it's so different from the way those terms are used culturally, you know, just in the world, where they're almost synonymous. When people talk about evil, you know, it's, what maybe they're really talking about is sin and rebellion, but it's put under this rubric of evil. Even without rebellion, there's still evil in your answer book definition of terms, right? There's still selfishness, there's still war, there's still people still do bad things.
Okay.
But it doesn't cross a line. There's a line that's crossed with in your answer book terms going to sin, because that's deliberate. It has a different quality about it. And
well,
I mean, I don't know.
The sense I have, Chuck, is that the course of every normal evolutionary world carries it through stages where sin is a feature of that world, regardless of whether rebellion occurred there as well. And
progressively,
as the stages unfold, fewer and fewer individual mortals choose sin, make sinful choices, and more guide their lives by spiritual faith in connection with the indwelling spirit and choosing to follow God's leading, and that more and more characterizes. But I sort of see sin as a stage that all the worlds pass through at points.
Well, can I read this, what Jesus says about that? Because that's kind of what I'm working from. This is in paper 148. And this is actually, well, I don't know if it's off topic, but it's a question that comes up a lot in our attempts to understand what the book means by evil, sin, and iniquity. And this question came up in the conversation that Jesus was having with Thomas. You know, where Thomas asks, why is it necessary for men to be born of the Spirit and of the kingdom? And he says, Master, what is evil? And Jesus, is rebirth necessary to escape the control of the evil one? So anyway, Thomas has got all these questions, and these are questions that, you know, have arisen on this world as to some degree as a result of the rebellion. And down a little bit in paragraph 6, he says,
oh, sorry, which paper?
This
which
is paper 148, section 4, evil, sin, and iniquity. So this is the one section where Jesus most clearly discusses these things. And he says in paragraph 6, by nature, before the rebirth of the Spirit, mortal man is subject to inherent evil tendencies. But such natural imperfections of behavior are neither sin nor iniquity. Mortal man is just beginning his long ascent to the perfection of the Father in paradise. To be imperfect or partial in natural endowment is not sinful. Man is indeed subject to evil, but he is in no sense the child of the evil one unless he is knowingly and deliberately chosen the path of sin and the life of iniquity. And then this is the sentence that's kind of the kicker here. He says, evil is inherent in the natural order of this world, but sin is an attitude of conscious rebellion which was brought to this world by those who fell spiritual light into gross darkness. So when they talk about sinless spheres, I interpret that to mean evolutionary worlds where sin was not brought to those worlds.
In other words, where evil and error are stumbled into. You know, they
still
have evil
and
error, but they don't have sin.
They don't have
That's an interesting idea.
They don't have this attitude of conscious rebellion, right? That's almost like it has to be revealed. From the superhuman level, for humans to realize that that's possible. It would never occur to them otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I get from that. But I've had long debates with other readers about this, so I know there's other points of view. But that's kind of what I get from that, and it appears to be echoed in that comment about sinless spheres, that there are spheres that have never experienced sin. Inconceivable, almost, from our experience.
Yeah.
Because it's so
well,
much
Marvin, you were
going to
make a point. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I'm open to whatever, but...
No, it's those are very interesting sections, to read and cause us to wrestle with these distinctions,
uh-huh.
I think. But I mean,
yeah.
What's interesting
and this,
to me is, you know, they're speaking of an experience that an individual and all of us have gone through at various points in our lives of knowing something wasn't necessarily the best course and then choosing it anyways. And I've
mm-hmm.
always understood that as a sinful choice, and that if we make those kinds of choices consistently and persistently in our lives become more and more sin-dominated. But I've never really thought about it that possibility of choosing something, even though we know on some part of us that it's not right, doesn't exist on a world where there has not been rebellion by higher beings.
Well, error, if you look at that as error, it definitely exists.
No,
if
I know
you make
that,
wrong
yeah.
choices and have that just
yeah.
live within the category of error.
But
I don't
know. The thing that bothers me about that, Chuck, is if what you're saying is accurate, that then on all of the worlds in a local universe, very very few are rebellion spheres.
Right. Exactly.
So what that implies is on all the rest of the worlds, beings do not make sinful choices, are never lost, and all survive. Those are the implications for me, and I'm not sure I read the book that way. So it's a conundrum. It's a bit of a conundrum.
Yeah.
I've always understood it that sin and sinful activity and the loss of souls, you know, is a feature of evolutionary creature life on all of the worlds, especially in the earlier stages of their development. But what you're saying is sort of introduces another possibility.
Yeah, they say
you're fading, Chuck.
Yeah, you're cutting in and out, Chuck.
Any better? Closer
keep going.
To my phone. Anyway,
yeah,
they in paper 89. Just a quick thing, they say sin must be redefined as deliberate disloyalty to deity. So again, we have the irascible kind of mapping out a type of behavior that departs from evil in some way.
Mm-hmm.
That it goes beyond evil. It goes beyond error. It becomes something deliberate, and it involves disloyalty to deity. Maybe unconsciously, perhaps, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think there's another spot in the book, you know, where they talk about how the Most Highs can step in a planetary emergency, and that they've done that a few times. And they say that even happens on non-rebellion worlds, even on worlds possibly without sin. Things can get so bad or out of control just based on evolutionary evil that they have to step in.
Mm-hmm.
So just because this other category of deliberate disloyalty may not exist on the world doesn't mean there's not still plenty of stuff going wrong and people acting in all kinds of ways, you know, like war, selfishness, passions, and revenge, and all of that stuff conceivably is within this category that Jesus refers to as evolutionary evil. And that can reach points of, you know, huge destruction and problems that have to be managed, even without crossing the line into this other category of that Lucifer promoted. So, you know, I don't know. It's all interesting and important, obviously, in some ways, in terms of understanding what's going on in this world, you know, in terms of what we're contending with. You know, we're not just contending with evolutionary evil, which by itself is plenty bad enough. Mm-hmm. And we have this added influence of the Lucifer Rebellion thrown in, you know, the unbridled self-liberty and all that stuff. So, I don't know.
Further, a lot of things to ponder.
Fuel for further consideration, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that comment about the sinless sphere is one of the clues that I picked up on in terms of my attempts to understand this, that there are such things. Sinless spheres exist in the universe, apparently.
Yeah, but in the section we were reading, it refers to a stage of far, far progressed light and life. You know, so the question is whether
that
spiritually all.
Well, just a minute,
ages.
Chuck. Let Marvin finish his point.
Yeah.
The question is whether that sinless sphere at some far distant stage in the age of one life did go through stages where sin existed and sinful choices were made in its earlier development, or whether sin never existed on that world in this definition,
right.
Meaning no one
right.
ever made a choice to go ways that were wrong and reject God and not survive. And I find that hard to accept, that whole worlds never experienced that stage, or individuals in those worlds didn't sin. That's a little far. That's a far stretch for me to go.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally understand. Yeah, it's hard, almost inconceivable.
Yeah.
But
well, it'll be interesting when we get to actually see some of these local universes, how they've been designed and put forward. We do understand one thing, that our local universe, the Lunanandex, for one, have been given greater latitude of freedom by, you know, our creator son than just about every local universe in Orvantan, save one, which is mentioned by name, Hensalon. And the implication is that there's far less in terms of rebellion in 99.99% of other local universes. You know, that if you've created your beings with less leeway of choice for their own good, on the one hand, as one of the parameters that you have control over, well, then perhaps there is less chance for things to go awry in that sense. On the other hand, they say that they expect there to be a quality of loyalty that evolves in our local universe that will justify the fact that we have had as much rebellion in our local universe that we've had. So interesting stuff.
Good comes from it. Just one last thought on this. In that sentence, I mean, we could read that sentence to say spiritual development, which characterize these advanced ethics of evolution on non-rebellion spheres
mm-hmm.
that have not experienced rebellion. That'd be another way to read that. And would that mean the same thing? Because we know most evolutionary worlds do not experience rebellion. So what is it that makes a rebellion world different from a planet that has experienced active rebellion, even by
planetary
currents?
Good points.
There's a difference.
Marvin, I'm going to give you the last word. We're down to our last 30 seconds.
Oh, we are. Wow.
Yeah, well, what I would say is the acme of material development, we've touched the surface, and it would be fun to really dip into it fully again next week with Paula's participation. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, we'll definitely recap the way we always do, and we'll project another section to read. We'll see if we get there. Okay, well, thank you guys.
Right.
It's been a fun 2 hours, and good conversation and interesting to explore these ideas about an age we can barely imagine. Thank you to Marvin Gowron. Thank you to Chuck Thurston. And again, I'm Andre Rodatis. We'll have Paula Thompson back with us next week here on The Cosmic Citizen. Until then, bye for now, everybody. Love you all.
Yep.
All right. Lots
have
of a love
great
to week.
You guys and all of our all listeners. Right. Lots of love.
Sure enough.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.